Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Once again, it's Progressive News Network. I'm your host, Rick Spezak, News Director of Progressive News Network. And I'll tell you, we've got a heck of a show for you tonight. We've got Ann Fonfa, cancer researcher, cancer health advocate. We've got Dr. Rachel Pienta, involved in Democratic Party policy. We've got Deidre McNabb, head of president of League of Women Voters. And we're going to have also Drew Martin from Palm Beach County Sierra Club, who's on the water board, and we'll be talking about water issues in the Palm Beach County East Coast area and giving us the latest news on that. First things first, as always, the news. Discipline and punish the dissidents. In the wake of the Great Clash, there was no accountability for the Wall Street cheats and liars and their filthy rich clients who crashed the economy. Federal prosecutors at the Department of Justice did nothing. U.S. attorneys like Preet Bharara of the Southern District of New York, Jenny Durkin of the Seattle home of WAMU, and Andre Birot Jr. of the L.A. home of Countywide were made to feel no real pressure to investigate. There were no phalanxes of FBI agents deployed to figure things out, no assignments of forensic accountants, no grand jury proceedings. The richly detailed findings of the final report of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission and the report of the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations headed by Senator Levin and Coburn were ignored by every single U.S. and state agency. It worked out just as Michel Foucault said it would in his book, Discipline and Punishment. But this delinquency of wealth is tolerated by the law, and when it does find its way into the courts, it can depend upon the indulgence of the judges and the discretion of the press. It's nothing. Nothing to see here. We can't look back. There's a difference between greed and criminality. Time to move forward together. We all have to have skin in the game. Too bad you lost yours, but hey, that's the great capitalist system in action. Not a single leader of either political party demanded prosecution. And yet, black men are gunned down by police or vigilantes at an astonishing rate. One every 28 hours, according to the After Alternet article. Although, as Digby says, there's no government figures on such killing. This is just the most visible part of the assault on African Americans. The abuse ranges from everyday harassment, stop and frisk, constant disrespect from police and the system generally, to roustings, jail arrests for driving while black, and constant fear of being killed for being black. How do our fellow citizens cope with this assault? Check the internet for the discussions of what parents have to talk with their kids, as here and here. Note the media's use of the benign phrase, the talk, as if racism were just a fact of life like sex. Note that the talk is about one-way communications, as though the young aren't entitled to input. And note, the advice the kids get to be polite, keep your hands in view, do as the cops or the authority figures tell you. When the kid gets killed, either by a cop or a vigilante or by a gang, there are rituals for healing. Pile up the flowers, the teddy bears, the candles, the notes. Do grieving through a burial. The shamanic advice didn't work this time, but just go on believing it'll work in the future. Be polite. Do as the authorities say. Keep your hands in view. The authorities smear the dead person and blame the dead person and muddy the evidence and do a lousy job of prosecuting. By 2011, it was clear the Obama administration had no intention of jailing the Wall Street criminals and that the Attorney General of New York, enforcer of the Martin Act, a state securities law that sets lower standards for proof in criminal cases, was going to let the crooks walk. The Occupy movement was one response. It was purposely nonviolent. It was met with an overwhelming militarized police force. Occupiers kept their hands in view. They were polite but firm with authority figures. But they got pepper sprayed. They got beaten. They got rousted. They got jailed. Then, nothing. No criminals went to jail. The occupiers were scattered. They disappeared like Amado Diallo protesters and those who are protesting at every other killing of a black person or a cop or a vigilante or a gangster. The cops who did Diallo killing were acquitted. We're already hearing that it won't be possible to convict Michael Brown's killer. In exactly the same way, millions of people were crushed by the Great Crash. Instead of help from the authorities, they got hammered by the likes of Foam the Runway Geithner. Do nothing prosecutors and the incompetent security law enforcement. They got blamed for the disaster as if it was normal for working people to be able to fool thousands of professional loan officers about their income and assets. The settlements that are being announced 6 years later are a big fat joke. We're in this together, say the authorities in the economics game, including the academic economists, CEOs, jackass TV commentators, Congress, White House, the banks, the financial sector. Heal up, you slugs, and get the economy going by yourselves, and give us our tax cuts and screw the Social Security and the Medicare and the Medicaid. People of Ferguson aren't sick. They aren't injured. They're outraged. And they're saying so in word and in deed. They don't need to heal. They need massive changes in their lives. And at least that means changes to the power of the entrenched authorities in both the public and the private sector. Instead, they get the sleepy potions like a demand for a hearing. The 99% crushed by the great crash need change in the power of the entrenched authorities there too. Healing doesn't help. It just validates the status quo. And it's the status quo that's sick. And as our president, that great Democratic leader, said, hey, you know, we tortured some folks. Torture some folks? The torture report. Recent revelations came at no surprise. However, there can be no doubt the United States tortured people. What are the repercussions? What are the consequences? The Senate team spent 5 years researching and putting the CIA torture report together. Apparently, it's quite thorough. What now? Well, they're delaying, you know, publication. And, well, you know, the CIA, you know, they destroyed those tapes. And, well, knowing this puts us in quite a bind. We can't simply say, or at least we shouldn't say, as Obama did a few years ago, that we need to look forward, not backward. The flaws in this thinking are obvious, as all crimes necessarily happen in the past. With this logic, the defense of a bank robber or rapist would be very simple. Hey, that was last week. What are you bringing up now? Torture treaties. The United States is a signer on treaties that make it clear that should a country find out that torture has occurred, they are required to prosecute the responsible parties and impose appropriate punishment. In fact, should a government opt to not prosecute, it obligates all other countries who are party to the treaty to take legal action to bring the perpetrators to justice. Spain took this to heart, but their efforts have been subverted by the U.S. pressure. Redactions. The CIA was given the right to redact the report. It's unclear why the agency is being accused of serious wrongdoing would be the one chosen for this responsibility. Not surprisingly, the report was so severely redacted that the word is it's all but useless. No names of the torturers, the countries that allowed us to do these deeds within their border, no names of who orchestrated and approved these crimes, all blacked out. As some have described it, it's a collection of verbs. In fact, even the identities of the people tortured are redacted. Really? Why would the government care if we know the names of people who were brutalized? I suppose one could argue that it would create additional civil liability problems for the CIA, or even worse, in the cases where the individuals were tortured to death. The Obama administration has said that the current redactions are fine. The Senate Intelligence Committee has cried foul, stating the redactions are only supposed to be for information that it released would harm the United States security. The purpose not intended to hide the names of the criminals or save an agency of the government from embarrassment. As for civil liability, shouldn't we expect it, even welcome paying damages to those we have damaged? Wouldn't it be the right thing to do? In our name. We should be outraged. I know. I am. It brings me to tears and turns my stomach. As a representative of you and me, did the people who did these heinous, despicable, and sadistic things, then they lied about the effectiveness of saying using these cruel methods to extract actionable information? Isn't it other countries that get people to confess to crimes they didn't commit with electric wires on the genitals, simulated drowning? Real drowning is only when you stop before the person dies. Beatings? Not us, not my country. People will do or say anything to make the pain stop. They'll even make false statements, like Saddam Hussein was involved with Al-Qaeda in the attacks of September 11th. All it takes is being drowned dozens of times. Every day, all across the country, people get harsh sentences for minor nonviolent crimes. Yet our representatives don't have the political will or the stomach to bring torturers to justice, let alone people who approve these methods. No, the criminals are free. The media invites them on talk shows as they pretend to be elder statesmen, pursue their hobbies, travel on book signings and tours, and in some cases having even bragged in writing about what they did. Granted, they are occasionally inconvenienced by not being able to travel to some countries for fear of arrest. All things considered, it's an awfully small price to pay for their crimes. But now, without any further ado, I'm going to go ahead and bring on our first guest, the charming, the talented, the well-informed Miss Anne Fonta. Anne, welcome. Anne, welcome. Well, maybe it's not Anne. We'll go on and continue the news. Super. Corporations spy on not-for-profits with impunity. This is an article by Ralph Nader, a voice you, I'm sure, will remember. Here's a dirty little secret you won't see in the daily papers. Corporations conduct espionage against U.S. not-for-profit organizations without any fear of being brought to justice. Yes, that means using a great array of spycraft and snoopery, including planned electronic surveillance, wiretapping, information warfare, infiltration, dumpster diving, and so much more. The evidence abounds. For example, 6 years ago, based on extensive documentary evidence, James Ridgway reported in Mother Jones on a major corporate espionage scheme by Dow Chemical, which focused on Greenpeace and other environmental and food activists. Greenpeace was running a potent campaign against Dow's use of chlorine to manufacture paper and plastic. Dow grew worried and eventually desperate. Ridgway's article and subsequent revelations produced jaw-dropping information about how Dow's private investigators from the Beckett Brown International included an off-duty D.C. police officer who gained access to Greenpeace's trash dumpsters at least 55 times. A company called NetSafe, staffed by former National Security Agency employees, expert in computer intrusion and electronic surveillance, and a company called TriWest Investigators, which obtained phone records of Greenpeace employees or contractors. BBI's notes to its clients contained verbatim quotes that they attributed to specific Greenpeace employees. Using this information, Greenpeace filed a lawsuit against Dow Chemical, Dow's PR firm, Ketchum and Denzenhall Resources, and others alleging trespass on Greenpeace property, invasion of privacy by intrusion, and theft of confidential documents. Yesterday, the D.C. Court of Appeals dismissed Greenpeace's lawsuit. In her decision, Judge Anna Blackburn Rigsby notes that however Greenpeace's factual allegations may be regarded, its legal arguments cannot prevail as a matter of law because common torts alleged by Greenpeace are simply ill-suited as potential remedies. At this time, Greenpeace has not decided whether to appeal. The court's opinion focused on technicalities, like who owned the trash containers in the building where Greenpeace has its headquarters, and whether the claims of intrusion triggers a one-year or a three-year statute of limitations. But whether or not the court's legal analysis holds water, the outcome, no legal remedies for grave abuse, is lamentable. Greenpeace's lawsuit will endure in the historic record to educate the public about the extent to which big business will go to stifle First Amendment-protected activities, wrote lawyer Heidi Bogosian, author of Spying on Democracy. It's critical, it's important, that organizations and individuals continue to challenge such practices in court while bringing notice of them to the media and to the public at large. This is hardly the only case of corporate espionage against not-for-profits. Last year, my colleague produced a report titled Spooky Business, which documented 27 sets of stories involving corporate espionage against not-for-profits, activists, and whistleblowers. Most of these stories occurred in the U.S., but some occurred in the U.K., in France, and in Ecuador. None of the U.S.-based cases has resulted in a verdict or settlement or even any meaningful public accountability. In contrast, in France, there has been a judgment against Electricité de France for spying on Greenpeace, and in the UK there is an ongoing effort regarding News Corp News of the World and phone hacking. Spooky Business found that many of the world's largest legal corporations and their trade associations, including the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Walmart, and Monsanto, Bank of America, Dow Chemical, Kraft, Coca-Cola, Chevron, Burger King, McDonald's, Shell, BP, BAE, Sansoy, Brown & Williams, and Eon have been linked to espionage or planned espionage against not-for-profit activists and whistleblowers. We'll get back to this later. I think we've got Ann on here now. Ms. Fonfa, welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
Oh, it's our pleasure to have you, Ann. You've been doing this work on cancer for some time now. You've been studying the materials, going to conferences. And what do we need to know today about the ongoing efforts that have been learned through cancer research?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I put together a list of some things I thought would be important to talk about. The first thing is the good news. So for a long time, my organization has been focused on people getting healthier before treatment, during treatment, after treatment. Conventional treatment, as most people know these days, is very, very difficult to go through. It's toxic. It creates short and long-term problems. And we at Annie Appleseed Project have created the idea or helped to create the idea of something that's being called prehabilitation. And that means from the instant of diagnosis, and really it's not limited to cancer, but at the instant of diagnosis, you have an opportunity to get healthier in order to be strong enough to go through treatment. So that involves the simplest thing, eating one more fruit and one more vegetable a day, and we say organic whenever possible. Being physically active to the degree that you can take a walk every day or a bike or something like that. You don't have to be athletic. And combining that with taking 7 deep breaths every day, either before you take treatment or before bedtime. The idea being that you would be healthier. So this simple idea has been is going to be shown in a poster at a cancer conference of the American Society for Clinical Oncology. And this is really the first time that anything to do with natural, even though it's so simple, has been accepted. So we're very excited about it, and that's on the really good news side. It's going to take place at a conference in San Francisco, September 4th, 5th, and 6th, and I will be showing this as a poster. When I sent the information in, I got an email back saying, is there, you know, what's your evidence for this? And I was able to send 4 pages of citations for evidence. So this is really a great step forward, and the advocate community sees that, so we're really happy. The second interesting thing that's going on is that there are more and more tests to determine whether people with a particular type of cancer should be taking chemotherapy. Now, I was diagnosed 21 years ago with breast cancer, and at that time I remember the doctor telling me I should take chemo and me saying, you know, do I need it? Will I benefit? And the answer was, well, we don't know. And I thought it was a kind of crazy idea to give people chemotherapy, which is toxic, without knowing if they would benefit. So now we're actually moving in a direction where we now know for at least 3 types of cancers whether people will benefit, and we're moving into more. Additionally, there are some blood tests, very, very simple tests, that can help to determine whether people actually have a specific type of cancer or not. And that's going to be a lot easier than the biopsies and things that were pretty invasive. And lots of times people don't have cancer and they've gone through a fairly difficult treatment. So this is a really nice step forward, and both of these things in my mind are really excellent. On the downside, what I see is a lack of cures. What we have is more and more treatment, I was thinking about this in terms of diabetes. So a lot of people know about diabetes, but what they probably don't know about diabetes is that it's never cured. It's treated, and it can be treated for a long time, but the problem with diabetes, like so many diseases, it's progressive. So people start the treatment thinking, oh, yeah, I'll be great. I'll just have to do this, and everything will be fine. I'll have my diabetic sugar or whatever. Not a good idea, because a disease like that continues to affect and attack your system. And I don't think that's made clear enough. So the problem I see currently is we are not curing enough diseases. We are simply treating them. And that works well for pharma because they get paid for treatment, but it doesn't work so well for the human beings. And I don't believe it's the only direction we can go in. It's the one that's been chosen. This is my opinion, but I believe, and I'm sure I'm right on this, most decisions are business decisions in the pharmaceutical industry. It's not a decision of, oh, we're doing this because it's the only possible way to go. It's the decision was made to go in this direction. What type of drug is promoted, what type of drug gets the research funding, all that kind of stuff is a decision that gets made. And right now the decision is we do really well if people get treatment on a long over a long period of time, whether they're cured or healed or helped or not. And what I've seen with diabetes in particular that's really been upsetting to me lately has been it's a progressive disease even when you take the medication. My own mother had it and was supposedly had a mild case. And at some point, we went to her doctor, and the doctor said, oh, her kidneys are in trouble. And I was shocked, and I said, how is that possible? The doctor said, well, what do you expect? She's taking diabetes medicine, you know, and that wasn't what I expected. And that's a problem. Now, in the cancer community, it's kind of been recognized that the younger you are when you're diagnosed, the more long-term problems you might be subject to. So it's been very important for children with cancer for their parents, of course, to understand that they need special care. And that's where the kinds of things that Annie Appleseed Project, my organization, nonprofit, comes in. We give information on how to do some simple protective things that might really make a difference in the amount of problems that people have. So those are the things that I focus on as much as possible. Also, as your listeners may know, we have coming up in November a vote on medical marijuana. And I've attended many different meetings and conferences to talk about this and to see what it will mean. And I think it's a very, very important thing to pass in the state of Florida for lots of reasons. But people with many diseases are impacted by the value of using medical marijuana. One of the meetings I was at, there was a woman who was talking about her elderly father who had Parkinson's disease. And she said he had the shakes, which is a very common problem with Parkinson's. And she said that it was really controlled when he was able to smoke marijuana. But he was nervous because it wasn't legal. And, you know, that's the problem we have. Nobody wants to go to jail for trying to take care of their health, but that's currently a situation and a great difficulty. So I'm actually going to be giving a talk September 27th at 10:30 a.m. at the Hagen Ranch Library about the benefits and value of medical marijuana. This is not going to be a debate. I'm going to talk about the good parts of it. If anybody wants to come and tell us how bad it is, they're welcome to join us and do that. But overall, it's going to be a talk about what it can do for us.
The only obvious downside I can see is for Big Pharma, that they can't charge us an exorbitant amount of money over the rest of your lifespan to treat you with an herb that grows rather freely. And, you know, you've been in the vanguard of a holistic and natural approach to treating these things for some time now. And I'm sure that this growing awareness that slamming already ill people with this radiation and with these incredibly powerful chemicals that seem to have, you know, the only benefit is that they poison the whole system and hopefully the cancer dies first. Seems like an odd approach to healing, doesn't it?
Well, you know, for myself, I chose not to take chemotherapy, and I also felt that my own health condition precluded it. I didn't know much at the time, but the more I know, I feel that there are some circumstances in which it might be justified, but mostly I think not. And I think people have to really think carefully. But, you know, it's very difficult to make a decision when you're scared. So I always tell people when they talk to me about what their options are, I suggest that people think about what it is they're looking for from treatment, what their expectation of the outcome is, and to make sure that their expectations match what's actually being offered. Because unfortunately, we tend to hear, in our fearful circumstance, we tend to hear, you know, we'll get exactly what we need if we follow all of the directions of the doctor. What I usually say to people, don't just take chemotherapy if you decide to do that. It's okay to do it, but you really have to make sure that you are protected. And we actually created a handout that's on our website, annieappleseedproject.org, that helps people to see what they can take safely, evidence-based, along with chemotherapy to reduce the toxicity if they make the decision to do that. You know, I don't recommend to people they do it or not do it. That's really not my place. I give Right. people information so they can make the best and most informed decision, which I think is very, very important because there's so many directions to go in, and when you're in your medical doctor's office, unfortunately, you don't hear about them. And you should. It should be freely given information so that people can make what we call the more informed decision. And then when they've satisfied that they've made the best decision for themselves, that's great. Go forward with all your heart. But always be protected. Always have at least complementary therapies if you choose to do conventional treatment. And ask a lot of questions. You know, the biggest question is, what is the expectation for me? What is the outcome for me, person in my age, my stage, my circumstance, you know, and so on. And, of course, as you know, the other difficulty is natural stuff is not covered by insurance. So if I say to somebody, the best thing that you can add is acupuncture, but I can't pay for that acupuncture for people, and it isn't covered. So I actually started a petition that's circulating on Facebook and through it'll actually be posted on our website shortly. It's a petition asking CMS, which covers Medicare and Medicaid, to have acupuncture be a covered service. It should be. It's been approved for things, and it's very, very useful for people going through cancer therapy.
You know, so often nowadays we seem to be hearing on one front or another, well, there's no real treatment for Ebola because there's just enough money in it. That there's no treatment for this because this one there's not enough money for. You know, it's pretty clear and pretty obvious that Big Pharma isn't in this for the good of humanity. They're strictly looking to make a buck. And I think when we look at them any other way than a strictly mercantile agency that's looking to maximize their bottom line, and if you get health from it accidentally, inadvertently, it's so much the better. Although they'd prefer to just give you medicine for a long, long time. We hear so much about medicines that have to be taken for the rest of your life. You know, it seems to me that hopefully more people will be looking at this commercial medical system that we have here. And granted, the Affordable Care Act has taken us a little ways down that road, but to really help the citizens, we clearly need to go further on down that road. Do you hear anything in that direction? Do you hear anything about how we can improve and enhance the Affordable Care Act in the circles that you work in?
Well, for me, the most important direction would be to get rid of the insurance companies. I don't know if that's really on anybody's plan. That's my plan, because I think the insurance companies are just off in a direction that isn't helpful. I mean, if they're making a good profit, that means they're taking that money from, you know, people who can use it for services and that. So for me, it's just the wrong, you know, the wrong direction. I would like to see them disappear. They're making decisions. They're forcing doctors to work crazy hours to have tons of patients. That part's really wrong. I mean, it's, you know, the doctors are sort of caught in that classic hard place, a rock and hard place, because they have to see a lot of patients every single day, and really you cannot give the attention that people need in that short period of time. I mean, they're saying it's about 7 to 12 minutes, and you're lucky if you got 12 minutes. You know, it's more like 7 minutes, and that's pretty crazy, and I do blame the insurance industry for that. So my feeling is that if we could really have a single-payer plan, we'd be in a lot better situation. And, of course, I'm not alone in that. I mean, it's a pretty common recognition that it's gone in the wrong direction. I don't know if it can be changed.
I attended the Democratic Convention in 2008, and I heard one Democrat after another up on the podium, including the person that ran for president last time and the person that's going to be running for president this coming time. And everybody, to a person, said, we're looking for health care for everyone, universal health care. That's where we're headed. That's what we're aimed at. And as that senator so coldly put it, that's not on the table. It was not really up for consideration. And that's too bad.
And there was no reason for that.
Max Baucus went to his reward, we know. But, you know, Ann, why don't you tell us a little bit more about your organization, Annie Appleseed? I think that you're doing so much good work, and you provide so much good information. There's never really enough time for you to talk about that. Why don't you tell us about that a little bit?
Well, thanks. Our mission has always been to inform and educate. We want people to make the best possible decision for themselves, and I can't make it for them. You know, what we do is provide information, the information that they mostly won't hear, particularly from their doctor, but that exists. There's a lot of evidence-based information about how to be healthier during treatment or after treatment or instead of, you know, conventional treatment. And this began for me because I couldn't take conventional chemotherapy. And because of that, I had to come up with some other ideas. And I'm 21 years out from my cancer diagnosis, and I found, what do you know, there are things that will work, and that was really astounding. And I actually meet oncologists who never even dreamed that people can not have conventional treatment and survive. So the organization, Annie Appleseed Project, has we're very active on Facebook these days, and we publish information every single day that might help people make good decisions. And so because we're all in Palm Beach County, we host an educational cancer conference every year. We're going to have our ninth conference, actually, in February next year in West Palm Beach. And it's a meeting that brings speakers in. We have speakers coming from Australia, from Europe, from a lot of other areas of the world who bring in information that might not be heard otherwise. And we want that information to be available to people with cancer so they can make the best of possible decisions. And it's very exciting for us to have this kind of meeting because we bring in about a third of the people have active cancer. We have lots of scholarships, and anybody who's interested should go to our website, annieappleseedproject.org, and apply for a scholarship. We bring in practitioners of all different kinds, and they can get continuing education credits, which makes it attractive to them. And we have family members and so on. And it's really a big, important event. It gets a lot of recognition, but we make a difference. You know, there are things that happen that are astounding for people, and it's really important for them to have the opportunity to see that there are other people who might be interested in the kinds of things they're thinking about and do it in a no-fear way, you know, in a very comforting. We serve organic food. We make it obvious that that really matters to people. It matters what you eat, and everyone in the audience should think about that. Eating more fruits and more vegetables positively benefits anybody in any circumstance. I mean, that's an absolute known thing. It should be the number one medical treatment in our country. It should be absolutely everybody is told to eat more fruits and more vegetables. But what we have is kind of I can't call it a gentleman because it's not gentlemanly, but it's a kind of an understanding that, well, people aren't going to do it, so why should we tell them to do it? But that's crazy. That's why we developed our simple program of three steps for health, which is one more fruit, one more vegetable a day, you know, being physically active. That's important to people, and taking deep breaths to reduce stress. Those three things, and personally I think it should also be detox and some dietary supplements. But the basics would be to eat more fruits and more vegetables every single day. It makes a gigantic difference in anybody's life, and that's, you know, that's what it's about. And we live in a country where it's not considered important and where a lot of the food that's offered is absolute junk. And, you know, people know when they're eating junk food and it's not okay. But the biggest problem is because it's so contorted the signage in stores is so confusing, and we don't really know what we're eating. People get confused about what healthy really is, and that's so sad. And that's on our, you know, our system. It's on the FDA. They're doing it wrong, and that has to change. So Annie Appleseed has a whole bunch of things that we're doing in a lot of different directions, but one of them is to try to teach people about better health. And then when you're going through treatment, we're there to show you things you can do to help reduce the toxicity. If you're going through treatment using unconventional or alternative or, you know, not the usual, that's great. We're there for you, too. We have that information, and we help make it available. I've been doing it for the 21 years since my own diagnosis, and, again, I did it because I had to. I needed to find a way to go through cancer without chemotherapy, and I was amazed and thrilled, and 21 years later found things that really work. So I am... you know, our website has lots of information. It's been up for 15 years, and we've helped millions, literally, millions of people, and we're here for anybody who needs us. Every single thing we do is free. We're an all-volunteer organization. We manage, you know, we don't get much money ever, but we manage. We hold on enough to be able to do what we need to do, and any donation is always welcome. It's tax-deductible to the full extent of the law, but we don't insist on people paying. If they need help, we're there.
Well, Ann, you're doing such tremendous work. Really an honor to help, in the smallest way, help you share your message. And why don't you give people those three rules one more time?
Okay, it's one more fruit and one more vegetable every single day, organic if possible. Taking a walk or being physically active every day, and then taking 7 deep breaths before bedtime or before some kind of treatment if you're in treatment. And those simple things will make it better for you. And we call that 3 steps for health. Really, it's 1 step. Once you take it, you'll feel better and you'll want to do more for yourself. And you can. It's all in your own hands. AnnieAppleseedProject.org has all that information and lots more.
So that's AnnieAppleseedProject.org.
.org, right.
And thanks so much. Keep up the good work. We'll try to come down and see your conference. When is that conference again?
February 26th to 28th in West Palm Beach. The information's on the website, annieappleseedproject.org. You'd be very welcome. Love you to come.
Okay. Thanks again, Ann. You take care of yourself.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
I know you're taking care of a lot of other people. Ann Fonfa of annieappleseedproject.org, a tremendous, tremendous gift to the community, a woman who is spending her time to make other people more healthy. That is tremendous. It's just the kind of activism that this show really, really salutes. And now we're going to go in a slightly different direction, from helping your body to helping the body politic practice democracy even better, you know, to form a more perfect union. So here we have Dr. Rachel Pienta with some words of wisdom about her work right now. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Dr. Rachel Pienta. Rachel has such a full plate of an incredible activist. In addition to being a professor, she's also Campus Vote Project Coordinator for State of Florida for the Fair Elections Legal
Network.
Network. Thank you. Dr. Pienta, welcome. How are you?
Thank you, Rick. I'm good. Glad to be here with you this morning.
Oh, it's our pleasure to have you, dear. Wow. Tell us about this project coordinator for the Fair Elections Legal Network. Wow, that sounds like a lofty goal in this state.
Yes, I think it is a lofty but worthwhile goal in this state. The Fair Elections Legal Network is actually a national nonpartisan organization based out of Washington, D.C., works across the country, and their mission is to remove barriers to registration and voting for traditionally underrepresented populations. And college students are actually, when it comes to voting, a traditionally underrepresented population. So, and we know that in terms of what our college student demographics are looking like, college students are very representative of growing underrepresented demographic populations across the country. So our young people are looking like what the nation of voters is going to be in 10 and 20 years, but we'd like them to start voting now that they're 18 and in college.
Wow, that's great. You know, I'm glad it's nonpartisan because we all appreciate nonpartisan efforts. Obviously, the League of Women Voters is another organization that's nonpartisan, but it's doing really important work for democracy. You know, it seems to me that you're called to do this at such a crucial time because we've seen so much, so very much. I mean, I think monumental levels of attacks on access to voting in this state and in many others. How do you hope to undertake this campus outreach, special events, literature, probably a lot of different tactics, I presume?
We do have a lot of different tactics. I'm doing outreach across the state of Florida. In the 2014 cycle, we're focusing a lot on the community college students because we're seeing that particular population probably didn't get as much outreach during the presidential cycle and traditionally doesn't get as much outreach. They're commuter students. They're often working. They have families. And access to the polls is not something that comes easily to the community college population. So, and also, we're seeing that the community college population is really exploding in the state of Florida as the state universities have to cap their enrollment and just can't accommodate all the young people who want to get access to higher education. So while we're working with several universities as well, and we're not turning away anybody, if the university calls me and says, we want you on campus, we work with them too. But my outreach is really focused on the community colleges this cycle. This week, I've actually been traveling across the state. I was in Miami earlier in the week, and then I was in Central Florida yesterday. And I've been on multiple college campuses meeting with staff, administrators, and students who work with student government. And the excitement that they have for working on this project is really heartening and amazing. I was just on one of the Valencia campuses yesterday in Central Florida. And Rick, I don't know if you're aware of some of the demographic changes in Central Florida, and how the population has largely shifted to a Latino population and a very diverse Latino population along that I-4 corridor leading into the Orlando area. And one of the student government presidents, Valencia has multiple campuses, and I met with all of the campus leaders yesterday. And one of the student body presidents says to me, well, we're going to do this campus town hall meeting, and it's going to be focused on issues that college students face, but we're really emphasizing voter registration, access to voting, and the issues that are going to be on the ballot this year. And I said, that's great. Whatever I can do, whatever partners we need to get there, that's going to be my focus to help you. And then she said, we're doing it from 6 to 8 at night because we want the college students to bring their families with them. Whether they have their own family, maybe they're already a parent, or they're going to bring their parents that they live with to campus. And we know that many of their parents are non-native speakers of English, so we're going to try to provide services in English and Spanish. And I just said, I almost got chills listening to her because that student gets where our voting population is right now and is doing this great frontline, on-the-ground work. And Campus Vote Project is all about supporting that level of work on college campuses.
Well, let me ask you a question. You know, so many of us who've been active in politics are aware of the standard get-out-the-vote thing. We're aware of how certain powers currently in Florida government have acted to restrict voting access, have shut down early voting days, have reduced the numbers of voting locations. How does that work in colleges? Are there voting booths on campus, or are they a lot of times, especially community college students, or what we now call state college students, they're working during the day, coming to school during the night. I mean, their time to access polls is limited even more.
It is very much limited, Rick, and that's a great question. And let me give a few parts of an answer. Some campuses have had polling places on their campus, but there have been some efforts to limit that. In fact, the University of Florida was just in the news last election cycle because their polling place was taken away. And both Senator Bob Graham and Senator Bill Nelson had spoken out against this because there had been a polling place in the Rights Union at University of Florida since I was a college student back in the dark ages. So it was really a crazy thing to say, now we're going to say University of Florida students don't have a polling place on their campus anymore because of some arbitrary decision that only so many polling places could be funded or open, and it's really related to this state restriction on access to polls. So what we're seeing with college campuses is that the polls are not on campus, and when do they vote? One of the conversations I had with the student government leaders yesterday was that they have campuses in two different counties. So they're dealing with supervisors of elections in two different voting areas, and so they're talking about wanting to provide transportation for students to the polls and the logistics for doing that. And you mentioned the fact that early voting days have been diminished significantly. So I was strategizing with them about using what early voting days are left, and the fact that it's at least one Sunday. In most areas in Florida, we don't have 2 Sundays of early voting anymore. So they've really restricted the polls to the polls type of activity that activists used to do to get people to vote together. But there's still at least one Sunday, and at most times a Saturday. So I was talking with them about using that early voting location because they could take a bus of students to an early voting location where you're not restricted to going to a particular polling precinct location during that early voting time, and that would be a time for students to all vote together, and they could really generate that excitement and have the group experience of voting. So we're trying to be creative with the fact that there are fewer early voting days. The polling places are not always convenient to campuses if the campuses are not located right in the population center, but then you also have students who may be traveling an hour to go to class. So they're not going to school exactly where their residence is. So their polling place is going to be near their house. But do they know where that is? Can they be there because they're in class, they're working, they're taking care of children, whatever the case may be? So do they know about absentee balloting? Are they able to go during early voting? Do they know that they can go to the supervisors of elections office and actually vote at any time the between till the election is over, because you can walk in and ask for a ballot on demand and vote, and that's something that not everybody knows about.
Absolutely. One other thing I wanted to ask, bipartisanship is always laudable in most arenas, in most situations. But here in Florida, we have a Republican Party, and let's call a spade, that has actively sought to limit access to polls, limit access to even voting, with the arcane standards that are being used to establish votability, if you will, or voting status. I think it would be hard to stand up against that without being seen by some as, in fact, partisan, despite the fact that voting should be outside of partisanship.
Well, that's a really interesting question. And actually, as I've been meeting with students and campus leaders across the state, they've said, we want to be really careful to be nonpartisan, and we're trying to be fair and represent both sides. If we bring candidates on campus, we invite everybody. If somebody refuses our invitation, we try to make it really clear that we invited them and that we have their literature, and we try to really keep it even-handed. But one question I keep getting asked over and over are from the student leaders. They want to know how to address hyper-partisanship. So they said, when we're out there doing voter registration and we're tabling about information and we're having an event that's devoted to voter education, trying to explain the issues, how do we address someone who really wants to keep pushing their partisan issues, because we don't want to be exclusionary, and we want to keep this about registering to vote and educating voters. So I actually have been giving students talking points about how to keep, turn it around and say, hey, this is about getting registered to vote and getting out the vote. However you vote, once you're registered, that's up to you, and we just want you to be registered and be well-informed, and then you get to make an informed decision at the polls on election day. And that they say that, and then not let themselves get engaged in some of the hyper-partisanship, even when someone's really trying to argue with them. This is a real concern. And we're talking about young people who are up-and-coming leaders. They're 18 to 24 years old, and they really care about this stuff, but they have been encountering this hyper-partisanship, which seems to be intimidating and kind of a turnoff to them.
Yeah.
From both sides, I have to say.
Youthful idealism is almost a cliche, and when youthful idealism faces what we might call the down and dirty of partisan politics, there's going to be a turnoff there for an awful lot of people, and unfortunately, given the gerrymandered lock on Florida government that the Republicans have managed to engineer, I think anything that presses against that status quo is going to be perceived as partisan. I would argue probably that even the most laudable League of Women Voters action to correct the heavy-handed gerrymandering is now doubtless seen by the Republicans in power as a direct attack, regardless of the fact that they're really just trying to make a legitimate effort to make the state fairer for the electorate.
Well, Rich, I think you make a good point, and that you may well be right. And to co-opt some controversial language from another Florida issue, I think that organizations like Campus Vote Project and League of Women Voters need to stand our ground and to basically stay on message for what we're trying to do and not be engaged in some of the parts sniping that happened, because like the League of Women Voters, Campus Vote Project, we are really doing work for the people, and that's for the people, whether or not they're Democrat, Republican, undocumented, independent, no party affiliation, what have you. It's about the people and making sure that they have access to information, and if they're eligible to vote, access to the poll. So we're engaging people, and it's not about the voter registration. It's about doing what's right and following the law and not using the law to limit people's opportunity.
Well, I don't want to, you know, drag all this into, you know, partisanship again and again, but I do it, believe it or not, out of a respect for that bipartisan effort, that partisanship-free stand that both your organization and League of Women Voters has taken, because, as you said, you know, democracy isn't Republican. It's not Democratic. It's not anything. It is an attempt to have government be representative of the wish of the people. And anything that stands in the way of that is to be fought. And anything that helps that is to be supported. So I really can't say how happy I am that someone like you, with your experience, with your breadth of understanding of people, is involved in this, making sure that college students have access to it. When you talk to college students, Democrats, Republicans, just people interested in civic responsibility, I would imagine that you are heartened often by the comments that you hear, by the engagement that you see. Is that true?
It absolutely is. When I sit in a room and I'm talking to students about these issues, I get so excited and energized. I was having a conversation with some students yesterday, and they were talking about doing a Constitution Day event on their campus, and they were saying, we're trying to figure out who to have talk, and we want to have people explain what the Constitution is and what it means to people's lives. And then they segued into talking about that in the state of Florida, and I said, oh, hold up a moment. I said, have you thought about talking about the fact that there's a difference between the United States Constitution and the state of Florida Constitution? And one student piped up and said, I just learned the other day that the state of Florida has a constitution. I thought that was just a myth. And I said,
oh my God.
You know, I had to hold back my smile. But we're talking about, you know, a young person here. And I thought, okay, this is the state of civic education, the state of Florida. I understand that there's been a push to really up our civic education curriculum, and this is why. And so, but we had a great conversation. It was a great springboard. I pulled up the Florida State Constitution. I had a projection screen available to me in the room. So I pulled it up, and I said, let's talk about what's going to be on the ballot this time, because they're doing ballot amendments that are amendments to the Constitution. And in Florida, we like to do this a lot. We tend to have we actually have fewer ballot amendments happening this cycle than we have in prior years. And then one of the students said, I heard that we have a lot of amendments in that, you know, we have more than other states. And I said, there's a perception that we do, that we like to actually do the direct democracy with our ballot amendment, and that if we don't get what we want in the legislature, we take it to the ballot. And then we actually had a great conversation about representative democracy versus direct democracy. And I left them with an idea of actually incorporating a skit into their Constitution Day, where they're going to have someone dress up to represent the United States Constitution. Someone will dress up as the Florida Constitution, and they're going to argue back and forth about how they're different.
Excellent.
And I thought, that's going to be adorable.
Well, you know, let me ask you to put on another hat. You know, we've been talking about tactics. We've been talking about the overall effort to engage the students. I think, if I understood you correctly, you also have been engaged with talking to them and educating them about the issues that are going to be on the ballot, especially the amendments. Could I ask you to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. What the students are sharing with me, that there is an interest because there are two issues that students either care about or feel like they know a little bit of something about. One issue is the Land and Water Legacy Amendment. And the students the environment is a very high interest for college students. And the other amendment related to medical marijuana, students hear about marijuana all their lives. And I have to say that the majority of college students are not, like, all about getting their right to smoke marijuana. That's not where they are on the issue. But because it's such a thing where people have talked about it and raised interest, they want to know more about it and what it means. So what I've been talking about with them is how to bring different representative groups onto campus to do voter education for their campus population, which means having an education forum where they have some different groups and how to set that up and how to structure it so that students will understand the wording on the ballot and what it actually means. We've had some good discussions about how sometimes the ballot amendment wording is very confusing. One student leader said to me this week, she said, don't they make it deliberately confusing? Why do they do that? And I said, that is a great point, and that is a huge complaint. The last election cycle, when we ended up having 10 amendments on the ballot, and the ballots were sometimes 30 pages long, that it was very confusing, and that people really had to understand those ballots before they went in if they had a chance of answering them at all. And we had a nice conversation with a group of students about, you know, why people might try to deliberately confuse the voters on a ballot amendment issue. And they have some great things to say, but they're candor in saying, that's terrible. Why would someone want to confuse voters? And I love that. I don't want them to lose that frankness, the candor and conviction of saying, pointing something out, saying that's wrong.
Well, sometimes the emperor's new clothes is about the only comment you can make. We have had some oddly worded amendments, that's for sure. Can you dig a little deeper into those amendments and talk a little bit about what is the medical marijuana amendment actually offering? Could you talk about that?
Well, you know, that's actually outside of the scope of the work that I'm going to do with Campus Vote Project.
Okay.
I'm going to let the constituent groups that are working on both sides of that issue be part of that on different campuses and help students make their own decisions.
Okay, fair enough. Let me ask you this. The project, this voting project you've got, is it going to run through 2014, 2016?
The plan is to have some incarnation of it in the next cycle, and now at the national level, there's still talks about what that will look like. The Campus Vote Project actually had a presence in Florida in 2012, and the Fair Elections Legal Network has been around longer than that. So the goal is to have something in place in 2014. What that will look like, if it's going to be state by state. Right now, we don't have people in all 50 states. We're moving up. We're ramping up, I think, to about 10 states within the next couple of weeks. So we're targeting, based on funding that's available, to have people in key states, Florida being a key state to target in 2014. So the idea that we could have someone in 2016 for what is likely to be another pivotal presidential election is the ideal, but they have to work that out in Washington logistically and with national funding, too.
You know, it seems to me that putting my political tactician hat on for just a second, that you're collecting information that's going to be absolutely invaluable to anyone who wants to do campus outreach.
There are a few groups out there that try to do campus outreach, like Campus Vote Project, and they have somewhat different angles, et cetera. And a lot of us talk to each other,
uh-huh.
And campuses, because they're very large bureaucracies and not everybody has the same title or performs the same function on different campuses. So on some campuses, you have a student activities office that really, you know, works with these type of student engagement issues. On other campuses, you may have an office of civic engagement and democracy, for instance, which is a trend on college campuses nationwide to have this kind of office devoted to civic engagement. So that they have that, that's another area where you're connecting with people. So just understanding the structure of different campuses is really important. But one caveat to this is that students who are there in 2014 aren't going to be on campus in 2016. And staffers may or may not be there as well. There is some turnover in higher education. You have some people who are lifers and they stay at the same institution forever. But there's some mobility in higher education where people move campuses or they get a promotion. So while some of the data is very critical and useful, some of it is not going to, it's going to be a trend indicator for 2016, but it's not going to be like, for instance, presidential election data where the analytics are able to be used for the next election cycle. So people like to use the example of the OSA, Organizing for America machine, their ability to drill down deep into metrics on voter data they've collected. Some of the voter data will be good, but we're expecting our college population to have moved, maybe even out of state. So in terms of tracking those students, I think we're still in the early stages of understanding how best to do that from cycle to cycle.
I was thinking of, which campuses have Democratic groups, Republican groups, which have bipartisan groups, the contact point, and obviously, there'll be transitions and slippage from year to year or even, personnel changes within those cycles. But I just was thinking, like I said, I work with a lot of different organizations that had dreams and visions of engaging all that youthful enthusiasm and idealism.
Oh, yeah.
And I was thinking, oh my God, when I was with ACLU or when I was working with this group or that group, we thought, oh boy, if we can only harness those college kids, oh my. But,
You do, Rick. You have a good point. And I'll tell you that I actually talk to those groups like the ACLU, and we share information back and forth. So if any group that you can imagine that might want to organize on a college campus, I'm probably talking to them. And we're able to actually help each other out with some information. And because I'm helping students organize things like engagement fairs, some of these groups are actually getting to come in and table because students don't necessarily know where to look for these people. They don't know how to ask the question. So part of my role is teaching them who might be good for this type of program, and
sure,
then also how to make the ask as well. So there's just training and some basic training in organizing, and I work with the student life staff and the actual campus administrators to help students learn these skills that are going to be transferable to what they may want to do after college.
Excellent. Oh, that's just excellent. I'm so happy that this work can be done, and you're such a perfect person for it. Could I ask you to talk a little bit about your other life, your work as a professor? What are you teaching this term coming up?
This term I am taking, I dialed back my teaching load, and I'm focusing on working with doctoral students this semester in order to have time to really devote to the Campus Growth Project, because there are less than 100 days between now and November 6th, and there's a lot of work to be done. My push is voter registration up till October 6th, till the books close for registration, and then switching to get out the vote and voter education for that last month. So teaching courses, in the past I've taught 4 courses a term of graduate students with 25 to 30 graduate students in a section, and it's an intense teaching load that did not always leave time. I know you don't believe me, Rick, because you know what other things I do. Did not always leave time for other things. So what I'm doing now is carrying a load of doctoral students that are working on dissertations related to one of my primary expertise areas, education policy. So, and keeping that, because I can do that work with my doctoral students at different times, I could read their drafts or schedule a phone conference at our, around people's schedules, that's fitting well with the Campus Growth Project work I'm doing. So I'm fortunate enough to be able to fix up my schedule and to have this opportunity to do this critical work at this particular juncture.
Well, if you'll allow me to dig just a little further in that particular direction, what's the current data on Common Core? Is there enough data out there? Is the trend? We all know there is some tension there, that it's not that its adaptation is not welcomed in all corners, and there are some on the right and the left who are opposed to it. What do you see from the data you've seen on the either the efficacy or the adoption rate of this Common Core education?
What we're seeing across the country is that Common Core in some form or another is being adopted widely, because that is the federal push that is happening, and school and state departments of education are going along with it. What you're seeing variations in are not the adoption of Common Core curriculum per se, which actually has been going on for 2 years. It started happening really quietly before it exploded nationally. And what really precipitated the national outcry was how we were going to do testing related to Common Core. And that's a large part of the argument, is that we're rolling out a new curriculum, and there hasn't been a lot of data collection. There hasn't been a lot of study of it, but we were going to hold students and teachers accountable for learning it or teaching it. and then have a test, which we weren't sure how it was going to be used. And so the idea, parents and teachers were saying, is this going to be another punitive test where schools are going to be graded, teachers are going to be punished, maybe, you know, pay is going to be withheld, what kind of negative things might happen? And because there's been this trend nationally, you know, as we know in Florida with the FCAT and the feelings about the FCAT, that there is naturally trepidation about the implementation of another system of accountability high-stakes testing. Now, I have to say that as an education professor who's worked with Common Core for a few years now, Common Core in and of itself, and I know this is heresy to some people, but Common Core in and of itself is not a horrible idea. It's another way to go about teaching, and it has its base and inquiry-based student-focused learning if it's done the way it was conceptualized. Now, the fidelity of implementation is a concern, and whether or not we have actual good training available for Common Core so that it doesn't lose the actual good elements it has, it's really questionable, and part of what teachers' unions and other advocacy groups are objecting to. And then, of course, the testing issue. How are you going to test the new curriculum, and can the test be validated? How are we going to use it? Are we basically having this big quasi-experimental data project going on with hundreds of thousands of students across the country? And I can see where people are getting a little tired of this tinkering towards utopia sort of action in education. Well, you know, I remember going, you know, I remember in graduate school, my professors, when I was earning my doctorate, telling me that about every 5 years, the latest fad in education would come along, and people would think they had the greatest, best answer, and they were going to solve everything. And they never really did, but they had some great new ideas. So, I mean, we've seen things like No Child Left Behind, Race to the Top, now Common Core, and it's like, okay, what next? And I think our teachers are having, you know, they're battle weary. There's fatigue with this testing stuff for good reason. And I'm a teacher's teacher. I've been an educator for a long time. You know, whether I'm working with students in a non-traditional education form or actually in a classroom, I'm all about the actual learning. And of course, we have to assess whether or not people are learning. But there are a lot of different ways to do authentic assessment that can be measured that don't have to be a high-stakes test. And that, I think, is the crux of this argument about Common Core, is that we've got this whole idea that we're going to try to overhaul everything, and then we're going to, someone's going to make money off new textbooks and new tests. And who might be doing that? And there's some suspicion there with good reason, because education has become big business, and there's a lot of profit making. And teachers, rightly so, have thought that it is off of their backs.
Well, Dr. Pienta, I want to thank you so much for sharing some time with us. I wish you every success with that really laudable work that you're undertaking, and I hope we can talk again soon.
I'm always happy to be a guest. I love talking to you, Rick, and thank you for providing this venue for us to talk about progressive issues in the state of Florida. I appreciate it.
Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was Dr. Rachel Pienta and her work to help the colleges and the college students get engaged in the electoral process. Don't forget to vote August 26th for progressive candidates. Next up, we're going to be bringing you a report from the president of the League of Women Voters, Ms. Deidre McNabb, and she's going to talk about that case they brought, which is trying to get rid of Republican gerrymandering here in Florida. So here he is. Here she is, President Deidre McNabb of the League of Women Voters. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Ms. Deidre McNabb, President of the League of Women Voters, a nonpartisan organization. Welcome, Ms. McNabb. How are you today?
I'm doing great, Rick. Thank you.
Ms. McNabb, some of us are aware that there has been recently a case in court about the way the legislature has drawn the election maps or the district maps. Could you explain how this all started?
Well, this has been a very long battle for the League and our allies on this topic. Gerrymandering is something that many people have heard of, and some are more familiar with it than others. But basically what it is it's incumbents drawing districts to guarantee and ensure that they will be reelected. And Florida has had a long history with that. And interestingly, when the League started 70 years ago, it was the first issue that the League picked up as really needing to be addressed in order to have accountable and good government. So it's been a long battle for us.
Wow. I had no idea that your work literally began with the same issue. So what precipitated this current dilemma?
Well, the current dilemma, we've been involved with it over the years, trying to get the legislature to pass statutory law that would end gerrymandering. And, of course, not surprisingly, the legislators never wanted to give up control over drawing districts to ensure that they would get reelected.
They didn't gallop toward a fairer election then, huh?
No, they did not. But what was exciting is that Florida finally got the right to have citizen amendments placed on the ballot to change the Florida Constitution a few decades ago. And that's when we began the march toward getting an amendment in the Constitution. In 2010, we were successful with that. We got what's called the Fair Districts Amendment that set rules for the first time for legislators. We've been really in court almost since then, because the legislature, went even after the voters in Florida passed it overwhelmingly, continued to use taxpayer money to fight the amendments and have really done everything they can all along. We've been in a multitude of legal battles on this. The most exciting recent decision was when the judge a few weeks ago threw out the congressional maps that the Florida legislature had drawn and said they were unconstitutional. So it's been a series of litigation. We've made significant progress, but we are not at the final destination yet where we have the legislators following the constitutional amendments properly, and we will continue the battle.
Let me draw some emphasis here that because you're so familiar with the battle and the issues at hand, that maybe the nuance of this hasn't really got to the audience. And let me put it this way. Would you agree that it's not easy to get Florida voters to agree on much? And yet they were outraged enough to insist in an amendment that we needed to have fair drawing of districts. Is that accurate?
Yes, it is. And interestingly, to put a new amendment in the Constitution requires more than 50%. It requires 60% of voters to come together on issues.
So
and,
in the face,
wonderfully
in the face,
they did.
In the face mm-hmm. of that vote, in the face of all these Floridian mm-hmm. voters coming together and insisting on a fair process, what did the legislature do?
Well, they continued to battle it in the courts, and that's been nonstop. And then when the amendments were placed in the Constitution, they signaled with great fanfare that this would be the most open and transparent process ever. And they scheduled a series of 23 listening sessions from Key West to Pensacola, all across the state, where large numbers of legislators sat and listened to the citizens give their input. Now, what the judge identified in his recent ruling was he said the legislature basically made a mockery out of the public meetings and all the claims that this was going to be the most open and transparent process ever, because, in fact, there was a shadow process going on with political consultants and maps being submitted under different people's names. And so the judge used very strong language. He said they made a mockery of their claims to be open and transparent. They conspired. And he talked at length about the shadow process. So we do feel that the judge has signaled very clearly that there is going to be enforcement of these amendments. And the timing put us in a very tight framework with an election that is just beginning. And we were dissatisfied, of course, with the decision that was handed down yesterday. But we will press on. Our plan is to go to the appeals court, and we will continue this battle until we feel that really justice has been done for Florida voters and that the legislature is following the rules.
Now, I realize there's very careful language you have to use in any comments you make. But what detail can you give us about the judge's recent ruling Thursday?
You know, unfortunately, I can't go into any detail
That's fair.
We're really at a delicate phase in the litigation process, but I can tell you that we are miles ahead of where we were years ago before the amendments were passed. And clearly, this is going to be a battle that is going to continue. Ourselves and our allies are committed to seeing this through all the way till the end. And it will be interesting also because there are a number of other states that have identified different solutions for gerrymandering. And there are a number of states that are still grappling in a mighty way with this and are looking to Florida to see how our solutions here are working. So that is one of the exciting things about America, is that you have a republic and you have the opportunity to see different states addressing challenges and opportunities in different ways and learn from the best of them.
You know, it seems to me that this is by far not a unique problem, that the allocation of voting districts is not something that just happens in Florida. As you point out, different states are trying different solutions. And I'm sure that through this process, you have looked at a variety of different approaches, whether it be mathematical formulas or regional formulas. What is, in the universe of political scientists, nonpartisan, what are some of the alternative approaches than letting the winners pick the spoils, which is evidently what we have?
Well, I think another very interesting solution, which we're looking at very closely, is California, which has it passed a proposition just a few years ago that put into place an independent redistricting commission as well as some rules. And I will say that we in Florida tried to do that as well. We have a restriction in our state that you can only put a single subject on a citizen amendment. So that constrained us, which is why we went for the rules first. But I can tell you this, we are going to be looking outside of Florida with great interest to see what we can learn from other states and implement best practices here. In the meantime, we are resolved, determined, and will not be deterred in any way, that we will keep this fight going to make sure that the legislators follow the rules. You know, I think Mayor Bloomberg came down to Florida to support our effort, and he had, I thought, a very instructive line. He said, gerrymandering is a little like the Worldwide Wrestling Federation. when you play the match, you know the results. Yeah, the results are already predetermined, and that is absolutely un-American, and it's unacceptable, and we will not rest until we eliminate the worldwide wrestling metaphor that Mayor Bloomberg referred to in Florida. That's not acceptable. It's not acceptable. People talk about our fighting men and women overseas, and they're fighting over there for democracy and liberty and for real elections where results are not predetermined. And we are so far ahead of where we used to be, but we are not at the finish line yet.
You know, let me ask you a question. And this is more aimed at trying to improve behavior than it is vengeance or punishment. But is there nothing we can say to these legislators who, to stretch a metaphor, basically are guilty of malpractice? They have not served democracy well. They have not been good stewards of their responsibilities. Is there nothing we can say to them that, you know, here they once again, under the close scrutiny of a chastisement by the voters to improve the process, here they went ahead and basically did the same thing all over again, you know, with a new layer of subterfuge mixed in for taste?
Well, you know, I think the answer to this is very simply civic activism. It is going to take citizens paying attention, making sure their voices are heard, and staying involved and attentive to what's happening in their government. And that is true for many issues, way beyond redistricting. We've got to be attentive citizens.
You know, I can the only response I can have at this point is, you know, thank the goddess Athena for people like you and the League of Women Voters, because my God, I shudder to imagine that if these people as they are were not being held somehow accountable for their behavior. Clearly, you know, if we had a more engaged citizenry, maybe this problem wouldn't even surface. But people are pressed as they are in so many fronts with so many issues that keeping them honest in how they redistrict is unfortunately, for too many people, is a bridge too far. You know, obviously you're going to take this to another court. Do we have any sense of the time frame involved?
You know, I think things will move fairly rapidly at this point, but we are in the midst of an election at the very early stages of our primary right now. You know, and I'd make an observation. One of my favorite quotable people is Winston Churchill, and he observed, and I'm paraphrasing, that, you know, democracy was far from perfect, but it beats all the other alternatives. And, you know, truly, I think it's one of the exciting things about our government in America is and the judge pointed out in his ruling was the first thing he talked about was George Washington's warning to the people when he stepped down as being our first president. He said, beware of the political parties because they want to maintain their power. And listen, political parties are an integral and very important and constructive part of our government. But, you know, with regard to gerrymandering, we have to be sure that districting is done fairly so the people have real choices. And that the people are picking the people they want to have represent them, not having the incumbents decide who they want to have vote for them. And that's what's at stake. And people who are listening should really look into a little bit what's happening in their state and how they might take an active role in setting rules and making sure that rules are followed and that we do have open, fair, and proper redistricting. So that we are trying to, you know, keep communities together in terms of splintering them apart to tip the results one way or the other.
You know, it seems to me that this is such an affront to democracy that if the system that decides who's available to be elected, if the system that defines basically we've engineered the electorate's dispersion and selection points such that we can guarantee a certain result. We've wandered very, very far from any kind of representative democracy, and it's essentially a government for those who already are governing. And it's such an affront to democracy. It's alarming to me that there are no alarm bells going off at the Justice Department. There's no alarm bells going off at the in the court system to really take this and put an end to it once and for all. There's got to be a better scientific method to do this, and I you know, beyond applauding your efforts, which without which God knows where we'd be, but I wish you every success, my dear, believe me.
Well, we thank you, and it's taken a huge number of volunteers, which is what the League is. I'm a volunteer. All our members, leaders across Florida are volunteering their time along with a number of other groups. And again, I think that the light is there at the end of the tunnel, because I do think we're making progress on this issue nationally. We certainly feel we are in Florida. So I don't want anybody to be in any way discouraged, because we are making progress against this long-time issue that has been a challenge for our democracy. And that's exciting. And it's important to feel needed and that you can change things for the better. So there's an uplifting message here, but the battle is not over, and we are excited about what lies ahead.
Well, thank you so much for your very, very generous time. Go have a human life. Thanks again, Ms. McNabb.
Okay. Have a wonderful weekend. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that was Deirdre McNabb, president of the League of Women Voters, fighting the good fight for democracy here in Florida. fighting for a fair election system. And you know, here in Florida, that is a significant uphill battle. Our next guest is a gentleman who's been with us before. He's one of the leading lights of Florida's Sierra Club. He's a gentleman who has worked on water issues, water quality issues, saltwater intrusion areas, and has taken responsible position on the water board in Palm Beach. Drew, are you with us?
Yes. How are you, Rick?
Very good, sir.
Yeah,
very good. Yourself?
Very good. And that's the Palm Beach County Soil and Water Conservation District, which conservation districts were set up during the 1930s because of the loss of soils, and they do a great service to the public.
You know, Drew, we've talked about so many areas with you in the past. Why don't you go ahead and take a couple minutes and tell us about the Soil and Water Commission?
Well, the Soil and Water Conservation Districts were set up originally during the Great Depression, and the reason they were set up was because so many farmers did not understand the importance of soil. And many of the farming methods were over-tilling the soil, and we had these dust bowls where much of the soil washed away. People don't realize how important soil is. Actually, much of our biodiversity in our environment comes from our soil. There is actually more biodiversity in our soils than there is above the surface. And the importance is there are many nutrients in the soils that are valuable to the production of food and the production of the plants on the earth, which are the basis of life on the earth. All life began as plants, and then those evolved eventually to those who ate plants, and then those who ate plants. So if we don't maintain our soils, we could end up basically with a world devoid of life.
And I understand from the science field that more and more the complexity of the organisms that live in the soil has become more and more, we've become more aware of it and how important that soil, if you will, those organisms in the soil are to maintaining plant growth.
That's correct. But unfortunately, much of what we've done in recent years has been to destroy the soils. In Florida in particular, we have a lot of soils that are sandy and muck soils. And the muck soils depend upon being hydrated much of the year, or at least during periods where they're wet, and that keeps those soils from drying out. Unfortunately, what we've had in the last 100 years has been draining many of those soils and reducing the quality of those soils over time. And some of those soils have actually lost a great deal of their elevation. We have soils in the Everglades agricultural area that have actually dropped 8 or 9 feet in depth because of not being hydrated.
And I understand that the opposite is also the case out west because they have lost groundwater. Soil is actually lifting up.
Well, the ground itself is lifting up. And one of the things that's very serious and it's going on around the world today is that groundwater systems are being tremendously overtaxed. And one of the problems is that groundwater oftentimes can be millions of years old. So to recover that groundwater can be not that easy. And we're not appreciating that. And when we are dependent upon producing food based on these groundwater aquifers and we're draining the millions of years of water in very short periods of time under the assumption that we're going to be able to do this continuously, we're really going to face a tremendous catastrophe. In California already, the land is actually rising because the weight of the water has lifted off that land and allowed it to rise. But at the same time, in places like Florida, when you drain the aquifers, you can get what they call our sinkholes, where the ground can collapse. And there are actually stories. I was reading a book by Cynthia Barnett called Mirage, and they mentioned how people have driven into areas and all the treetops were at ground levels because the ground had sunk so quickly from over-drying the aquifer.
Incredible. Well, we always talk about saltwater intrusion, but let me ask you the alternate question. We've had a pretty good rainy summer. Isn't that the case?
We've had a significant amount of rain here in Palm Beach County, and that's been beneficial. Of course, we can get even more rain if we get a tropical depression or a hurricane.
And has our... go ahead.
One of the problems, though, today is originally when that sort of rain situation would happen, because we had so many open spaces and wetlands, that would rain would get into our aquifer system. Now, because so many wetlands have been destroyed, much of that rain is just rushes right off the land, down gutters into canals and off into the ocean. And that's one of the unfortunate things, because much of that is contaminated water. So by not maintaining our wetlands, we're not holding much of that water in the aquifers that we would have 150 years ago.
I noticed I just recently drove across the state, and canals and lakes are looking pretty high right now. Have we had enough rainfall during this rainy summer to help us through the dry spell in the winter?
We've had enough rain to maintain our existing system. However, we are currently pulling huge amounts of water out of our aquifer system, and that is one of the things that we cannot continue to do forever. And even when you have these heavy rain events, unfortunately, because of the way our drainage systems operate around the world today, we don't hold most of the water. And this is one of the big problems, is that most of this water is running off and running out to tide, particularly in places like Florida, because we don't have the wetlands that would normally hold that water in place so they could it could fill our aquifers. So it can be somewhat misleading, because we can get a lot of rain, but that doesn't mean that we may have enough water if we get a year of drought, because we can very quickly use that water through overpumping of the aquifers.
I see. What other current water issues are before the Soil and Water Conservation Board these days?
Well, this is an issue, and Soil and Water Conservation Boards, just so that listeners understand, do not have regulatory authority. So we are basically there to provide input to those boards which have the authority, which are the water management districts and the Army Corps of Engineers, who have the ultimate regulatory power. One of the things that's very interesting, and if you read the book Paving Paradise by Craig Pittman, you will see that one of the big problems right now is that the rules that were set up to protect wetlands are not being followed. And one of those rules is called 404, and that was a rule that was part of the Clean Water Act. And one of the problems has been is that originally that rule was intended by Congress to establish regulations so that anytime anyone drained a wetland, they had to get a permit from the Army Corps of Engineers. And the Army Corps of Engineers was supposed to ask a very specific question, and that is, why do you need to build this particular development on top of a wetland? Could it not go somewhere else? And the purpose of that was to prevent draining of wetlands unnecessarily, because wetlands benefit us in so many ways. They recharge our aquifers. They also clean the water before it runs off. So they're basically like a great filtering system and a sponge that's absorbing our water and at the same time cleaning it. So when it gets out to our water bodies are pristine, which is why if you came to Florida 150 years ago, every water body that was a running water body would have been crystal blue, like Lake Okeechobee, the Lake Worth Lagoon. All these, you would have looked into them, you would have been able to see clearly to the bottom, which you cannot today. These 404 permits have been corrupted over the years because developers, since 1980 under Reagan, have been trying to prevent this protection from happening. They call this red tape, because they don't like to have to respond to a permit. They want to be able to just get a permit without having to make any kind of justification. So these 404 permits have been very easy to get. in fact, the Army Corps of Engineers basically rubber-stamped the permits and made it almost a given that when somebody asked for this, they would get it. Well, now we see what's going on in places like Lake Erie, where the water is becoming so extremely contaminated because of the quality of water that is getting into our rivers, our lakes, and our estuaries. So there's been a push under the current EPA and to tighten up these rules. There's been a fight between those on the right who want no regulations. They don't think there should be any regulations at all. We see this in West Virginia, where the water was completely poisoned by runoff. People who have this power, economic power, see that they feel they have the complete right to completely contaminate the water, and no one should ever tell them they can't do it or make them pay for the damage once they do it. These people have been fighting through the Supreme Court to take this power away. At the same time, the EPA and other groups and environmental groups have been saying, no, you can't have no regulation. You must have regulation. So there's a huge fight right now going on in the United States between those who want no regulation on water and those who want to have that regulated. And one of the arguments is what makes water area or a wetland a regulatory area. And so the belief among the environmental community is that all water touches all other water bodies. So if you have a pond, you have a stream, you have any kind of thing and it touches, eventually that water is going to flow into some water body, and if it's contaminated, it's going to harm the environment. So we would like to have a strong regulation. And the EPA has been working on coming up with a strong regulation that ties all these water bodies together. On the right, you have people saying, no, this is an infringement on our rights as property owners. So right now, the EPA is going through this rulemaking process, and those in the agricultural industry and the development industry are claiming that this is a government overreach, that the attempt to regulate water bodies that they call not navigable water bodies, like a river, is an overreach. So this is the issue that is going on right now, and there's a great deal of fighting going on because the Chamber of Commerce, the Farm Bureau, and some of these other groups are putting out the message that there is a great attempt to overreach in the regulatory field so that they'll have to clean up their water bodies. And one place this is taking place is in the Chesapeake Bay, where the five surrounding states came up with an agreement to protect the water quality of Chesapeake Bay. And this agreement is being fought by people like Pam Bondi in Florida because the ag industry is putting pressure on them and the big business and the developers to stop any attempt to clean up the Chesapeake Bay, even though Florida has no relation to that.
Well, you know, let me stop you there just for a second. Now, I am puzzled to try to constrict some chain of logic that would have Florida resources be spent to help dirty the Chesapeake Bay against the will of those who are there. How does that benefit Florida if they can pollute the Chesapeake Bay more?
Well, the problem you have right now is that you have two types of agriculture. You have agriculture, you have farmers who do a good job. And they do a good job because they have buffers around their fields and they capture their runoff and they clean it through artificial wetlands or real wetlands or natural areas. And they don't just let their refuse kind of run straight off. And then you have big corporations and big agribusiness and these things called CAFOs, Consolidated Animal Farming Operations, which are producing so much pollution, and they don't want to take any responsibility for it. And so those operations are fearful that any regulation will impact their ability to make money. But the point is that some of these operations are so large that they are impacting the water to the extent that we have up in Lake Erie, where we actually saw poisoning of the municipal water for an entire city Because the problem is when you have nutrients such as animal manure or overuse or large amounts of fertilizer and pesticides and all this, and it runs into a water body, what might be beneficial on a farm is not beneficial in a water body. These sort of nutrients cause algae to grow and bloom. And as algae grows and bloom, some algae can be extremely toxic. And as they die, the bacteria that are eating them are actually sucking the oxygen out of the water. Now, when this water becomes extremely contaminated, these things can produce things like flesh-eating bacteria or microtoxins that are so poisonous that if you drink them, they can kill you. So, you know, there has to be a happy medium. We want to be able to produce food. We want to do it in a way that does not harm our water bodies to the extent that everything in them dies. And an example of that is in the Gulf of Mexico, there's a 10,000-square-mile dead zone that's actually moving its way towards southwest Florida. And if that strikes southwest Florida, it will kill everything in the water. Literally, you will just have an ocean of everything being dead. And you know, that's not good for tourism.
You know, I laugh, but those of us who've been paying attention have been watching that thing grow over the decades. And last I heard, I think it was the size of, was it Connecticut?
It's huge. And this is all because of phosphorus and nitrogen that are running off farm fields in places like Michigan and in Iowa that feed into the Mississippi River. And it's all because those nutrients are not being captured by the farms and by these big CAFO operations. And some of it is also sewage out of these cities. And all this is accumulating into an extremely deadly, toxic mess. And so we need to come up with a way to get these groups to produce food but not do it in a way that it destroys the quality of our water systems. In order to do that, we have to have regulations, and these regulations that the EPA is trying to write are something that would be assist. And one thing about regulations is they benefit because they give everybody an idea of what the standards are. Businesses oftentimes say we don't want regulations, but the reality is if you're a good, capable business person, you just want to know what the rules are so you can follow those rules. We should always enforce them in a way that helps people meet the standards. We don't want to punish people to the extent that they can't be in business, but we want to have solid regulations that everybody understands so that they're easy to meet and people know the rules they have to live by.
You know, I know some small businessmen who happen to be in the auto service business, and they're being visited on a regular basis by water and sewer department representatives to make sure that their runoff is contained, that they're not draining anything into the sewer system. And, you know, they're being pressed to be sensitive, and they are. They are environmentally aware. They are taking the necessary precautions. They are carefully handling their waste and sending them off to responsible waste contractors. You know, it just seems to me this is one more case where the small businessman is being pressed to observe the rules closely, whereas Big Ag and Big Sugar gets a pass. It staggers the imagination. These people could be getting a free pass on all this stuff.
Well, it depends a lot on you know, the political power of the entity that's being regulated. And one of the unfortunate facts are is that somebody with a lot of power can oftentimes hire a lot of lawyers. They can fight enforcement actions. And then you have cases like in Florida with the DEP where basically the people who work for the Florida Department of Environmental Protection have been told not to go forward with any enforcement. They are not allowed to. So I don't know the specific story of the individuals you're talking about, but I would bet that the agency that's doing that enforcement is not the State Department of Environmental Protection. It's probably the local government. And
right.
Oftentimes when people feel, you know, that there's some oppression from government, it's generally local government that they feel that hand up, because generally speaking, the large government agencies don't have time to put their fingers in all this. They basically want recommendations to these, give these people recommendations, and then they hope that the people will meet those recommendations. In the case of best management practices for farms in Florida, it's voluntary. Nobody is really punishing farmers at this point. They are being asked to meet these. If a farmer in Florida meets best management practices and they voluntarily do that, then the assumption is that they're meeting the standards. They're unlikely to be punished. So it, when it comes to agriculture, there really isn't a lot of punishment going on. Now, there are other types of standards that are much more rigorous, like food safety standards. And there is some concern among some of the small farmers about the food safety standards that they're being asked to adhere to, because big agri corporations can meet those standards much more easily than the small farmers. So there are cases where things going on can be much more difficult for the small operator than the large one. So you're right that it can be, but that's where we need good regulators who understand their job. We don't want to punish the little guy. We want to help him stay in business. And that's the purpose of regulation, is to benefit everybody, because we need clean drinking water. It's no one's benefit, including those in business, to have drinking water poisoned at the tap.
Well, you know, I regularly try to talk to conservatives and even Tea Partiers. And, you know, as soon as they start laying all that anti-regulation, anti-big government out, I have what I think of as a really simple argument that I make. And I said, you know, I understand what you're saying. No businessman likes to feel that someone's looking over their shoulder. I said, but let me ask you it this way. Let's turn this around. Would you like to know that the food you're giving your children is safe? That the medicine that you're providing them when they are ill, that it's safe and will actually do something efficacious? And they say, well, yeah, of course, that. Well, yeah. And I said, well, that's the product of regulation. That's the product of government standards. Now, can you imagine if we let pharma provide the evidence for the safety of their products, or we let big ag decide that, hey, it's perfectly fine if we just use pound after pound after pound of pesticide and we engineer our plants so that they can just be literally drenched in poison and still live. Now, what good they're going to be for people is another question. But it just seems to me that when you say that to people, even the most vociferous right-wing anti-government person, they do recognize that, yes, in fact, they do depend on safe food, on safe medicine, and maybe, in fact, that the absolute position is just simply what it is, foolish. Drew, let me ask you a philosophical question. Sir, you've been in the arena of water quality and water safety for some time. What's it going to take? Is it going to take a dead lake? Is it going to take the dead zone creeping up from Tampa to Fort Myers that no one can touch the water? I mean, is it going to take something like that? Dead Lake Erie? I mean, what will it take to make regulators turn from the checks and do their job?
Well, I think, Rick, when you talk about the Clean Water Act, it took a fire on the Cuyahoga River in Ohio. And, you know, the unfortunate thing is we were very lucky in both Virginia, West Virginia situation, and the situation that just occurred in Lake Erie, that no one died. No one died. The water was extremely contaminated, but in the West Virginia case, the people who turned their taps on realized there was a problem, and they told the authorities, and they got it in time. And in the Lake Erie case, the same thing has happened. People were able to find it before anybody died. Unfortunately, we cannot continue this way forever. At some point, somebody somewhere is going to end up dying in it, and I hope that doesn't have to happen.
You know, I'm just afraid there's a Bhopal on American soil right around the corner, and it's not going to be dependent on ISIS or a terrorist, it's going to be the damn terrorists that don't care about pollution. Well, that's a painted a little corner for ourselves right there. Let's hope it doesn't get to that. Let's hope that before we get to that point, that there are cooler heads prevailing, and that the dollar isn't the only currency involved here in water safety and water cleanup. But, you know, you mentioned the West Virginia case. Their legislature was in session. They drew up tighter laws on water safety and water pollution. And you know what they did, Drew? They exempted the coal industry. That's not even appalling. It certainly ill serves the public. That's for sure. Let's see if we can find some other more positive way to close tonight's. Do you have any good news for us, Drew?
Well, I think the good news is that people stay involved, and it's really important to have public officials hear from the public. And there are a lot of people who work for the government that want to do the right thing. But if they don't hear pressure from those who want to do the right thing, and they only hear pressure from large corporations that basically treat everything as a dollar and cents. It's just like the case in West Virginia where the company made money, they didn't care about the end result, and then they were allowed to go bankrupt. And those are the kind of problems where there's no accountability. So there needs to be both financial, and we need, at some point, we're going to maybe have to see somebody go to jail, as in cases of West Virginia, where there's just out-and-out malfeasance and lack of concern for the welfare of the public.
Well, let's hope it happens before there's a Bhopal here on this shore. It's entirely possible. You know, when you look at what's going on and that huge explosion at the fertilizer plant in Texas, they still don't want regulation. I was talking to a woman in Colorado who was a frustrated green, and she said she can't believe her neighbors who will, on the one hand, complain that the result of those floods last year in Colorado washed away all kinds of tanks that stored the poisonous results of the oil drilling there and the fracking there, polluted their streams, killed the fish, and yet they don't want any regulation. She said she confronted three or four people and said, wait a minute, you're complaining about the pollution, the destruction of the water, but you don't want to see it regulated. And unfortunately, that kind of short-sightedness, you know, it seems to me there's only one kind of cure for that, and I'm afraid that people who think that way are going to reap the benefits or the deficits of that kind of thinking. You know, I support the fact that, you know, you are working to try to make the water and the soil of Palm Beach a better thing, a more survivable, a more life-sustaining thing, and that's fantastic. But you know, I salute the fact that you've been in this battle for a long time and have kept the faith. You know, I think that's awesome. And we salute you, Drew.
Well, thank you, Rick. Well, I salute you for your great radio show and the fact that you interview a lot of people and get the message out to the public, which is an important job, and we all appreciate that.
Well, thanks. Thanks very much. You know, right now we're faced with the opening of the eastern shore of the Atlantic to drilling. And, of course, the seismic testing goes along with that. Think there's going to be a public...
Many marine mammals.
Yeah.
Which will kill and deafen many marine mammals.
Do you think there's going to be a public outcry?
I hope so. I hope so. I think we need to get the Florida politicians need to be speaking up, because we haven't heard much from the Florida politicians opposing this. And I'm surprised. We don't need to wait until there's an oil spill in our area. We're seeing the Gulf oil spill was far more devastating than anybody realizes. And many animals are still dying from that. Dolphins, sea turtles.
You don't agree that oil just magically disappeared and all that corrects it too?
No, I don't think it did. And I think that, you know, I'm not going to. And right now, British Petroleum is paying for the damages, and they're being allowed now to bid on oil contracts. So I mean, I don't think there was enough punishment of British Petroleum, and it set a poor example because it is going to indicate that the U.S. is not going to take strong action when the oceans are polluted. And the oceans are the end game. You know, you can lose a lake or a river, but you can't lose the oceans. We will not have human life on Earth if we destroy our oceans. That will be the end of it.
It's certainly going to play hell with the cruise industry.
Well, they're doing a lot to pollute the oceans as well, unfortunately.
Actually, just relatively recently, they've actually been required to start handling their waste better and their effluent. Isn't it true?
Well, I think the industry, a lot of it's doing some voluntary. It's been mostly voluntary. But unfortunately, cruise ships are giant cities out on the ocean, and once they're on past the 12-mile limit, there's not a whole lot of regulation, and unfortunately, most of them are not U.S. corporations. And there's been a real reluctance on the part of the United States to cause these ships to improve their quality. Some of the cruise ships, and there's a rating system that I think Friends of the Earth does, some of the cruise ships do better than others. Some of the industries have been some of the companies have been much more willing to improve. But the cruise industry throws a tremendous amount of waste into the oceans, and it's something that's really unfortunate because they go to a lot of beautiful places, and, you know, they're leaving a lot of pollution behind.
Well, sir, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Drew, you always have good, valuable information for us, your insight. Coming from years and years of work, we appreciate so very much. Honestly, in my opinion, we can't have you on enough. So thank you so much for joining us.
I appreciate that.
You're a cool head and a very knowledgeable person on the water issues and soil issues. So thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Rick. I appreciate your invitation to be on your show.
Okay. You have a good night, my friend. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, sir.
And ladies and gentlemen, we're going to leave you with a wonderful bit of music that will remind you what we're here about and why we're here. And I want you to think about that while we get ready to leave. And I hope you'll tune in next week. And we want to leave you with this thought.
I saw Joe here last night, alive as you and me. Is I but Joe here 10 years dead? I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe said, I'm standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. It's more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die, says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life, smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, there you find your hill. I'm